Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Brandon Douglas, 22 years of career experience, Division Chief of Training with the Rural Metro Fire in Knox County, Tennessee. Firefighting wasn't on his radar for Brandon, but after having a discussion with his father, he decided to apply, and within a few weeks into his academy, he fell in love with it. What I like about Brandon's story is the fact that with any occupation, there's going to be highs and lows, but all it takes is that one individual to see the potential that you might not see within yourself that forever changes the path in your career. With that, I present Mr. Brandon Douglas.
So my name is Brandon Douglas. I'm currently Division Chief for Rural Metro Fire. I got my start in the fire service really accidentally. It wasn't something that I thought about a lot as a kid. It wasn't something that was really even on my radar, which is kind of funny because my dad has been in emergency services for 40 plus years on the EMS side. But anyway, I kind of on a whim talked to him one day, and he talked to some people and found out that there was a recruit academy coming up. So I didn't really know what else to do. So I threw my name in that. Surprisingly, got selected. And I mean, within the first week or two, I kind of knew I'd found what I wanted to do with my life. And so I went all in for a long time, hit, you know, the same kind of maybe burnout, ups and downs as anybody else. But then in like the mid, right around 2014, 2015, was a pretty big time in my life. My daughter was born, things were changing at work, and I had a leader that took some interest in me, and really he always had, but it kind of helped me see some potential that I didn't see in myself. And that's sort of what really lit my fire, so to speak, and got me to where I was really learning more and progressing more in education and training and everything to kind of get me where I am now. So can't imagine doing anything else.
Okay, fantastic. For those that don't know, including myself, can you tell us a little bit about Rural Metro Fire? How many stations, personnel, things of that nature?
Sure. So our Knox County operation, we have 17 stations spread out. If you think of Knox County with the city of Knoxville in the middle, we do most of the donut around the city. There are two other departments in the county that have their areas, but we have pretty much most of the rest. So more or less, we protect about 250,000 citizens. Our staffing, we run kind of a minimal staffing model. So we have a grand total of around 175 to 180 members that's on the truck and off the truck. You know, three shift system, 24-hour shifts, three battalion chiefs on each day. Minimum staffing of two for most of our apparatus, but we do have three engines that we run as technical rescue squads, and they run a three.
Okay, but your most of your apparatus ride two.
Yeah, most of them are slated for three with a two minimum.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. And as far as department discipline, engines do engine work, trucks do truck work, or is it depending on?
It depends on order of arrival. We have two trucks that are, you know, staffed, but it just kind of depends on when they get there. And so we try to use them for truck stuff, but sometimes they're doing engine stuff, and same with our engines. Sometimes they're doing truck stuff, and it's kind of Iron Man firefighting when you're a little bit lower on the staffing side, everybody's got to work.
Understood. And on, if a, first due residential structure box comes in, what's your first alarm assignment?
5 engines, the truck, and 2 battalion chiefs.
Okay. And are your stations, you said 17, are they, I'm assuming, covering that much distance? They're probably spread out a good bit.
We are. It varies depending on which part of the county you're in. So the West Knox County is a higher density population. Those stations are a little closer together. You get out into the east end of the county, that's a little less densely populated, and you get more distance between stations, and the north kind of just rides right in the middle.
Okay. All right. So with that being said, you applied and you got hired. Upon entering the fire service, and you mentioned it, which I'm sure we'll hit on the ups and downs, but At first, upon entering for Rural Metro, did you try to find the individuals you wanted to emulate, or did you just see growing up through the fire service, like, man, like we have individuals that are just here just for the paycheck, just for to say that they're firefighters?
I think so, probably both, right? I'm pretty fortunate early on to have been like my academy, the academy that I went through, that staff was top notch. And I was really, from day one, it was very easy to identify the people who were successful and why. And again, I don't want to harp too much on our staffing model, but when you're not running four people to a truck, it's really hard to harbor a lot of the say this politically correct, like the lower performers, right? So
Right.
most of the people that I was around were very much good role models. But certainly, every department has their percentages, so.
Oh no, I mean it's everywhere. But with Rural Metro situation, running two to three and the distance, depending on where the location of the incident is, you shouldn't have members that are hiding in plain sight. It is, you know what I mean? Like
Right.
the performance has to be there.
It has to be there. Yeah. And that's even so we've grown a lot in my 20 plus years. Like when I came on back then, there were probably around 70 to 80 full-time staff. Now we're up to, and not counting like the chief officer, just like the members on the trucks. And now we're up to about 140. So just people on trucks, right? So we've grown a lot. But no, like there's not a lot of room to hide. And so, everybody performs well because they kind of have to.
Which is a good problem to have.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Are your members EMT basics, paramedics, or
Yeah, we prefer paramedic, but the state of Tennessee has changed some things over the past maybe 10 years. It's made paramedics a little scarcer. So, but all we have only recently hired a handful of people that don't have their EMT, but they're contracted to get it, in a certain time frame. So, yeah, all of our apparatus run at least BLS, preferably ALS.
okay. Any transport?
No, we tried that for a little while and got out of that game.
Gotcha. Understood. I think it's an expensive, and I don't want to say game, but it's an expensive field if you're going to get into that. The ALS side of transport, ambulances, medications, and things like that.
Yeah, and it was ultimately, it just proved to be entirely too taxing on our workforce. The guys that were assigned to those trucks were just absolutely beaten down day after day. And just the way our system is with, kind of how people get to work at different stations or get different assignments, it's pretty heavily seniority influenced. And so we were having a lot of turnover on the bottom end of our list with those new hires getting on the ambulance and just getting beat down. So that was a big reason why we got rid of them.
I understand. I totally understand that completely. It's a topic for discussion. You have your larger agencies that are able to do that, but on the flip end, like I could tell you from my experience, not so long ago I went up to DC and I rode for a little bit with a buddy of mine, and DC has ambulances, and I mean it was crazy to see that the medic crew at that station, they literally have lunch boxes packed. And they just sit in the truck, and when they're gone, they're gone. Like you
Oh
don't
yeah.
see them until
Yeah.
later on in the day.
Yeah. My last assignment as a captain was at a station that had one of the ambulances at it. And we were on the far northeast end of the county, pretty much as far away as you could get from some of the hospitals. And these guys would, they'd run a call, and before they could even start back to the station, they're catching another call because they're close by. I mean, we wouldn't see them. You'd see them at shift change and then maybe around dinner time, but then they're out the door again. It was
Right.
rough.
Yeah. No, for sure. Okay. All right. So, let's talk about you coming up through the ranks. You're now a division chief of training. And I'm sure back then you weren't thinking about it, but or maybe you were, but
No.
was like getting to a chief's position always the goal? Maybe not first when you entered the fire service, but as years of service under your belt, was it like, I might entertain this?
I think for me, I even like my first promotion. So I promoted lieutenant in 2011, and that was, again, our department's changed a lot. There's been a lot of organizational changes and things over the years, but the position back then was very much, it was kind of an admin. Like, you're still in the truck, but your responsibilities had way more to do with making sure reports were done and training hours were logged than actually leading a company. So that was something that I had the opportunity to do and figured I'd give it a shot. Beyond that, I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And there was even kind of a point, again, like that 2013 to 15 range, where I was almost ready to just go do something else.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I didn't, we had, so there was, at the time I was a lieutenant, my next option was captain, which in our whole department at that point, we only had four of. And then from there, there were only three battalion chief spots. So it's like that pyramid just very quickly narrowed. And I didn't really see a lot of chances there until, again, there were some changes in the department. I had a battalion chief that kind of saw more in me than I saw in myself. And he gave me the opportunity to actually act up as a battalion chief. And once I started doing that, I was like, oh man, this is awesome. Like, I actually like this a lot. And you get to see everybody, get to, help the guys out day to day, run these big calls. And so once I started down that path, it clarified more that that was what I wanted to do. And so, but really what drove me was like, I wanted to be in whatever position I could be to do the most good for the most people, regardless of what rank that was. And so that's kind of what led me to the training chief spot when it opened up. So here's a chance to kind of help everybody out, even outside of, my battalion. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay. And with that experience that you had with that chief seeing something in you, what advice could you give to other company officers out there who know that dialed in individual that maybe just needs a little nudge? And I say this with a little bit of bias, because there are some individuals who are totally okay with being a backstep firefighter for their entire career, and they're great at it. They're positive leaders and role models. But if you have that individual that maybe all they need is just that little bit of like, hey, like, seriously, I believe in you. I think you can do good at this. Like, what's your advice for those company officers out there?
This is not a good answer, but I think it's going to be super situational and depend on the individual. Ultimately, you got to have a relationship with that person. There's got to be trust. They got to know that you're coming at it from a genuine place. And I think you kind of like, you flank them a little bit, right? Like, he didn't come to me and say, hey, I think you have a brighter future and I want to put you in this position to make you better. It was just like, they've gotten kind of a note from on high that, hey, you need to pick a backup for when you're not on shift so we can kind of keep some continuity. And so he picked me. And so there wasn't really a lot of fanfare about it. It was just like, hey, you're the guy. Okay, cool. We'll see how this goes and I'll try it out. But having his support through that, putting me in the position and supporting me through it, was kind of it's sort of an end around way to show that confidence in me and help me find it in myself. Right. I don't know that it's anything anybody could have sat down and told me. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. Okay. You mentioned earlier that, at one point in your career, you looked at exiting the fire service, and I got to a point in my career where I thought the same thing. I didn't think it would ever happen, but looking back at it, it just goes to show you that, the fire service truly does have ebbs and flows. And regardless if it's things going on in your organization, your outside life, at some point you have to make a decision. And so you decided, like I did, to not exit and stick with it. So what's your take on, I mean, everybody's going to have a different reason, but like, what's your outlook on the fact that you stayed?
Certainly no regrets. I think, the things I was thinking about doing were higher risk, higher like financial livelihood risk, right? Like the fire service if nothing else is consistent, you know, unless you just really screw up, you've got good job security, right? So I think for me, like deciding to stay had a lot to do with my daughter being born, right? So now I got a child, wife, you know, family, and I got to really be thinking about long term. But then too, it's just, it was, this is what I know. These are the people that I've known, you know, at that time for 10, 15 years. And I just decided, basically, I'm kind of rambling, I apologize, but I basically just hit a point where I said, I'm already thinking about leaving. Why not try to do this other thing? And if I don't like it, or if I don't get there, you know, if I don't get promoted, or if I don't have the impact I want, then I'll just leave. What do I have to lose?
Okay.
And it's
I
worked
get
out.
it. No, I got you. I got you. Okay. First official question I always like to ask, what does the term aggressive, in your opinion, mean to you?
So I think aggressive is when your knowledge, training, education, and experience align well with the situation and your interpretation of it. So that's going to be one of those things that's going to differ from person to person and situation to situation, right? Your well-trained, well-educated, well-experienced captain that shows up on a two-story working structure fire and takes their crew and you know, rushes through the front door, you could call that, potentially call that aggressive. Same company, same captain rushing through the front door of a Home Depot with nasty black smoke coming out of it. Now they start pushing towards reckless, right? So it's like if you think of a range between cowardice and recklessness, aggressive is going to slide along that curve depending on the individual and the situation. Makes sense?
Yes.
So
Yes.
that's kind of how I think about it. So are you thinking about what you're doing? Can you back up the decisions you're making with experience and training and all that other stuff? And have you really accurately measured the situation before deciding and acting on it?
Okay. All right. So with a couple of years under your belt, what clicked or what prompted you to move up from firefighter to the next rank within your organization? And
So,
did you feel like you were ready for it? Sorry.
oh God, no. No, I was so our from basic firefighter to we had at the time called OIC. It was an officer in charge. Wasn't a ranking position, but you were acting basically as a company officer. I took that step, I mean, within 2.5 years maybe of being on the department. And really even from that going to lieutenant, which responsibility wise, the only big responsibility change, like I said, was the admin portion of it. So I personally, I think, and this is no fault of anybody in my department or training or anything, I had no true understanding, I think, of the responsibility that I had at that age in those positions. And not having that responsibility, or not having that knowledge of that responsibility, frankly, is probably what allowed me to do it. So I really, it's a terrible answer, but I really didn't think about it a whole lot until I started working towards battalion chief because I knew that one carried weight, as they all do. But that was the first one that for me really hit how much weight that one carried. And so as far as being prepared, again, I'm not trying to talk bad about anybody or my department or anything, but for a long time, we really didn't do a whole lot to prepare people for positions. It was just kind of an assessment to see if they if we thought they were ready and just kind of tossed into the deep end. So, thankfully, you know, always surrounded by good people that you know just want everybody to succeed, and so it's always been a bit of a team effort, but I figured out as you go.
Okay. And that's one of those things too. A decent number of departments, and I'm not really sure what it is, but like, you know, preparing an individual for a company officer role to me is more than, okay, can they give a proper size up? Can they follow our SOGs and SOPs on how we do things? It's, and I feel like where we fall short is not really on, I don't want to say the tactical side, because like most departments operate however, you know, with by the guidelines, you know, the set in their rule books and things. But I think where we fall short is, okay, tactics aside, this individual is going to be over a specific number of individuals. In this day and age, people are going to have issues in life, you know, whether it's marital, going through life, financial, whatever the case may be. And, you know, being with you being like a company officer, there's nothing in the book that goes, all right, you have your firefighter come up to you, close the door in your office, and like, hey, Cap, Lou, whatever your title is, I have a drinking problem. Let's just say that. And then it's like, all right, well, where in the book? Let me go search which page that was. You know what I mean? Like, that's not, it's not in there. So, I totally get what you're saying with that, but it's one of those things where I feel like hopefully, and I'm sure there are departments that are making strides with that, but you know, we always fall short in the category when it comes to the human factor of being an officer.
Well, sure, and I think so. I've been pretty involved with our promotion stuff now for 6 or 8 years. And the development aspect of that too, huge part. And man, it's hard. It's easy to find standards and skill sheets on tactical stuff and hands-on stuff, right? And when it comes to doing our promotions, like I very rarely am concerned about somebody tactically. Like our guys are pretty locked in and can make good decisions. Some of them may have some test anxiety in the actual assessment itself, but I know these guys can go do it. I'm not worried about that part, right? It's what you're talking about. It's all the interpersonal stuff. It's all the stuff that's in between running calls. That's where you're going to find yourself in hot water. That's where you're going to get yourself or somebody else in trouble if you're not doing the right thing or kind of thinking along the right lines. And that's hard. It's really hard to figure out how to train for that. And so it's stuff we've been working on, but to some degree, I think that's where, really from a young age, as far as like forget actual age, but young in the fire department, encouraging them to be that lifelong learner, like find things you're interested in and read and study and learn. Because the more you do that, the more you're going to start getting that, building that empathy and that kind of sense outside yourself that's required to kind of be able to navigate those situations because you can't plan for everything. We can't have a training class on how to handle every interpersonal issue you might run into. And so just building some kind of a foundation of how to interact with people in a productive manner is going to do a lot to where that person, at least in that position, hopefully they realize, hey, this is beyond my scope to handle by myself. I'm going to make sure this person knows that I see them and I hear what they're saying, and it's a non-judgmental space, and I'm just here to help, and I'm going to figure out who to ask for help. And that's all we need to do, right?
No, that's awesome. Okay. this next question definitely goes with your title. I'm not sure what Rural Metro's training budget is, but what kind of things do you do to bring in realistic training for your members?
So I mean, nothing's off the table. We don't have a training center right now. We've been between for a little bit, so we've had to be creative. And so for us, we are really dedicated to developing our people as much as they want to develop themselves. And so if somebody wants to go to a conference, we send them to a conference. If somebody wants to go to a class, we send them to a class. We send people to, FDIC, NFA, State Fire Academy, technical rescue classes. So we do probably more dispersing our people than we do bringing people in from the outside. But we have done that. Like we've got guys with some connections, and we've brought in different forcible entry training and rescue training, and really anything we could do to provide exciting different stuff and let these guys listen to somebody besides me or some of the other guys that they see all the time, right?
Yes, definitely. Okay. And so with you saying, with you stating what you just did, I'm probably going to say you're probably a firm believer and proud influencer of outside training.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I came on in 2002 at 18. So it was, probably 10-ish years. I don't remember. Whenever social media took off, there's a pretty big chunk of time of my career where there was no social media. And so they're really short of, Fire Engineering, Firehouse Magazine. If you didn't know about it, you didn't know about it. And so there was, but even then, my department was sending guys to FDIC, and we had the fire engineering and the stations. And so there was a little bit of outside influence even back then when it was harder to come by. But now, like to turn your nose up at outside training opportunities or bringing people in with fresh perspectives or sending your people out to get different perspectives, it's insane. Like I can't even express how much I got out of spending a week at NFA beyond the class, right? It was the people you're interacting with. It's the same with any conference you go to. So to not value that, I can't wrap my head around.
I get it. I get it. And unfortunately, we have departments and individuals that look at it as well. I don't want to spend the money for it. We don't do things the way said department does things. And yes, if you attend a conference and a class, when you come back to your organization, you got to be tactful. You can't just come back and be like, listen, we've been doing this wrong the whole time. Shove it down people's throats. They're not going to want to hear that. But if you go, hey, I went to a class and I learned this, I think the biggest thing with way these cadres and these conferences, the way they're set up is listening to fresh ideas and bringing back certain things and making it work for your jurisdiction. Not saying you have to adopt the entire manuscript, but because every jurisdictional area is different, geographically, rural, urban, suburban, whatever the case may be. But I think if we come back calmly and nicely, go, hey, this is what I learned. Is anybody interested? And then, hey, I think if we take this piece and plug it into this part of our rules, regulations, processes, it could be better than that.
It's I heard it's probably a weekly scrap or something, but I heard the phrase operational reality, and I was like, oh man, that's it. That's it. You got to take whatever you learn, put it through the lens of your operational reality, right? Does this work with your manpower, your resources, your staffing model, your whatever, your area? And if it does, then yeah, like, hey guys, let's go try this thing out real quick. Let's see what we think of this. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, but it's worth a shot. And I mean, we've had tons of innovation through that, right? Usually beneficial.
Okay. Awesome. So I'm gonna kind of ask, when the chief of training came up, was it something that you were like, or did somebody go, hey, I think you would be good at this spot?
It was more the first than the second. I think it was I wasn't in a hurry, right? I really enjoyed being a battalion chief, but the opportunity came up and I talked to a couple of people that I whose opinions I deeply value and was supported in kind of throwing my hat in the ring. And it wasn't without reservation. Like, this is a Monday through Friday gig and I have never done that, right? So there was a lot of thought, a lot of talk at home, a lot of talk at work. And at the time it was an interim position, so it kind of seemed like a good opportunity to test it out and see if it was something I was interested in, should it become permanent or not. So sorry
I can hear you. Are you good?
about that. Okay, you still got me?
Yep.
All right, sorry. So I that made the decision a little bit easier, thinking it was potentially short term. But no, it was something I had thought about as a possibility. Again, I've always enjoyed training. I really like thinking kind of longer range program design, curriculum design. So it just seemed like a fun opportunity. And again, being interim, it wasn't really like a, I'm making a permanent change right off the bat. It wound up being a permanent change, but yeah, tough decision, but one that I had a lot of good support on, so that helped.
Okay. And with you being, like I said, chief of training, I look at it, this is just my perspective, and I am not an instructor, but what I do is I call it, I am an extra set of hands when it comes to assisting an official instructor with whatever topic. But I find value when the instructor is in the same attire as the students, like, especially being in Tennessee. If it's hot out and you're in a t-shirt and pants and duty boots and your students are in gear and they're sweating, and you're telling them, like, come on, like, let's push harder, push harder. I think I don't want to say your credibility, but to me, that kind of looks bad, where it's like, well, that's easy for you to say. You're not in this gear sweating. And so What's your take, and how do you do things? Like, are you, if you're going to teach or show a skill, are you in the attire that the student's in?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to make sure you're not putting up unnecessary barriers. So yeah, if you're teaching it, especially if you're teaching a new skill or refining a hands-on skill, yeah, by all means, be in the same, be, wear whatever they're wearing, feel the same thing they're feeling. Because there, obviously, as you know, there's a big difference in moving a hose line in your duty uniform than there is in bunker gear, right? So it doesn't really do me any good to show you a technique in my blues that I need you to do in bunker gear. So yeah, no, I think as much as it makes sense and as much as possible, the instructors should be right there with their students.
And do you chomp at the bit if to get your gear with them, especially if it's like some sort of live fire exercise, or even if it's
Oh.
like, hey, we're short, can you ride the truck for a little bit?
Yeah. We did a live fire evolutions a month or so, a couple months ago. We had a house we could use, and so I was in my gear inside with those guys every chance I got. Yeah, no, I'm not going to pass up an opportunity for that.
And in your opinion, do you see that no matter how high you move up the chain, like you should never forget your role as a firefighter? You know what I mean? Because like there are chiefs out there, and with the this day and age of social media, you know, it's easy to proclaim yourself being a chief, but if you forget your roots in a sense, like it has an effect on your guys kind of going along with you.
Yeah, and there's I think like with anything, there's a balance you got to walk. And you can't forget where you came from. You can't ever become too detached from the job that you're asking other people to go do, right? But if you're overly concerned with the image you're presenting to the men and women that work for you, you risk slipping on your responsibilities to them that they don't see, right? So by all means, take every opportunity to go visit stations and jump on trucks and put your gear on and train and make sure that they understand that you still not only understand what they do, but respect what they do. But don't let that detract you from the job that you have to do to support them day in and day out. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Okay. All right. Next topic of leadership. I mean, with you being a chief officer, so I'm going to ask you, what is your personal opinion on what leadership should look like, what it should be like, and the reasoning for that individual to feel like they want to become that leader? Because we all know those that have never really applied themselves at all in the fire service, and a position comes up, and all of a sudden that person's testing. They're hitting the books hard. They're engaged now. They're like, "Hey, man, like, how do you feel about this? Let's go out and do that." Like, we all know those individuals, and then
Sure.
some look at it for the pay benefit. And I'm not saying that's wrong, but if your reasoning behind getting promoted is your first answer or your first response or reply is more money, I think that's wrong too.
Yeah.
And then you have your titles, your title holders. They want the rank for the title. But what's your leadership, you know, in your opinion? Like, how do you look at that?
So, like I said, for myself, it's speaking just for myself, it's always been about, what can I do? Where can I put myself to where I can do the most good for most people? And it's not to say that that other things don't factor into those decisions, but that's kind of the driving force, right? And so anybody is going to have a multitude of decisions why they're wanting to promote. And some it's for money, some it's for rank and title, privilege, agency, whatever you want to look at. But hopefully, the driving cause is because they want to actually help lead other people, right? They want to take care of the people around them. It's like, why do you go to paramedic school? Assuming you don't have to for your job, but if it's a choice, why do you go to paramedic school? Are you doing it for a pay bump, or are you doing it so that you can provide better care on these calls you're already running, right? So ideally, somebody that's going up for promotion wants to be a leader. It's somebody that first and foremost wants to better themselves so that they can better others. And then, of course, those other things are going to factor in there. But if that's the driving force, then that person is they're going to excel. They're also probably themselves leadable. Not only do they admit mistakes, but they embrace their mistakes and use them as learning opportunities, right? Like that's the stuff I like to look for. Harder to measure, but when you see it, it's great. And that those are the people that you really want to cultivate and hold on to.
All right. For promotion to company officer, are you in favor for a simulated computer fire scenario or a scenario involving real people with real companies where you're graded at real time, either at a training center or a designated site where you can actually see the individual or the candidate go through the motions?
So here's a fun one. I think both are equally, I don't want to say useless, but you're not going to get a good read on somebody's actual abilities in either situation. So having done both, I've done promotion processes where we have had, we've used not real fire, but real buildings, training facilities, commercial facilities, I mean, actors, trucks, the whole nine yards. And there are people that I know on the street would perform completely different than they did in that assessment center. Same with the simulated tacticals. I know there are people that could go out and handle these calls without hard, with hardly even having to think about the decisions they're making. They're making the right decisions, but you put them in this situation where they're being assessed and analyzed and evaluated on everything they do, and it changes them, right? So this is like documented. It's called the Hawthorne effect. As soon as you start observing something, you change it. And so what I like about, so kind of to answer the question more directly, for me, it's more beneficial to do the tactical simulation because that is frankly cheaper, and easier to put on. And if I'm not going to actually measure their performance, their true performance either way, then we might as well go for the one that is less taxing. So we use tactical scenarios in our promotion processes. And what we're slowly moving into is looking at them differently, like redefining the tool and what it exactly it is we're trying to measure. So rather than trying to measure how is candidate A going to perform on a real apartment fire where they're first in, second in, third in, whatever the case may be, as showing up as a captain or showing up as a battalion chief. We're not trying to assess how they're actually going to perform. What I want to be able to assess using a tactical simulation or even a live drill would be great if we had the ability to do it, is do they have the algorithms in their head, right? Is it, do they know the steps they need to take? Do they know the strategies and objectives? Do they know how to handle their resources appropriately? You know, you start getting up to captain, battalion chief level, definitely. Do they know how to use a command board to make sure that this stuff isn't getting too disorganized? And so I don't want this to sound derogatory towards assessment centers or tactical testing or anything, but to me, if you know what you're testing and you know what you're looking for, you can almost treat it a little bit more like a national registry where you're coming into a situation. And you're looking at a screen, you know, you would a national registry where it's like you either have a medical patient or a trauma patient, you run the appropriate algorithm. You walk into a room and look at a screen, you either have a residential fire, or a commercial fire, or hazmat, or whatever it may be, and you start running the appropriate algorithm. Because what that tells me is this individual has studied, they've trained, they've practiced on this, and they are showing up prepared. Does that mean that they're going to leave that assessment center and go run that exact same call and perform flawlessly? Of course not. But you're not going to guarantee that either way. But what I can guarantee is the knowledge is there. Once the knowledge is there and you start adding the experience to it, now you start really growing the kind of fire officer that you need out on the streets.
Okay. And if you could have it your way, how would you potentially promote an individual to company officer? Let's just say you had an abundance amount of money, any facility you wanted.
Man, well, there again, so if cost wasn't an issue, then yeah, it'd be super fun to do it with, you know, full on 1403, like let's burn a house down. And really, if you really wanted to have a fun experiment, you know, put a helmet camera on them and don't have any assessors out there. Just evaluate the footage afterwards. I mean, that's probably the closest you're going to get to really assessing how this person's going to do in real life, right? They show up with them and their company. There's nobody there watching them, and all we can do is evaluate the footage after the fact. That I think that would be a fun experiment to try if you had the ability to do so. But for me, again, like, and every department's going to be different. My department, we're not really bound by a lot of rules and regulations as far as our promotions go. So what we're trying to build right now is a system that actually puts way more weight on the individual's day-to-day engagement and personal development, professional development than it does on their performance in an assessment center. Like the assessment center is almost just going to become a kind of a pass-fail. This person's ready to start riding up the next level or they're not. And the real emphasis of the promotion is going to be on their job performance.
I have to say, I do like that thought that you had, because I can tell you from experience, like I tell everybody this, I'm not a great test taker. Like, especially when it comes to written tests, I really have to focus in on what I'm studying. And then if I'm successful, assessors, that's another thing. You pull up and you have like three or four people just watching everything you do. It's nerve-wracking. And I'm sure there are a lot of great dudes who maybe, especially probably their first time, they know what they're doing, but they just bomb it because of nerves. And then maybe the second time they get it because they're used to it. And I get it. The more you expose yourself to that, but that having as an another set of eyes watching you, man, it can really mess up your game flow. And then, because it's funny, because you can go from having to do that to being at the firehouse on shift, you get the exact same call, and they're awesome.
Yes, no
But
problem.
I love that idea of put a helmet cam on, and then you'll watch the footage afterwards and judge from there. Granted, you might miss some things. The camera can't always get everything. I mean, it probably can, but at least then you can also maybe ask questions to the camera. Hey, why did you at this point here? Why did you do what you did? But I love that notion. I've never heard that taken. I really like it.
I think it'd be neat. I think you'd still have some test anxiety because even if you don't see the assessors, you know you're still being assessed. And I think if as the evaluator or the proctor, if you threw the instruction in there, like, hey, do your best to articulate your thought process as you go through this. Like, just talk to yourself. Yeah, articulate the things you're thinking about doing as you're doing them. Like, hey, I'm doing my 360 and I'm looking for utilities and I'm looking at windows and as much as you can just to help the evaluators. But again, like if you're the only way, like one step beyond that, if you work somewhere where you're running fires all the time and you gave all your officer candidates cameras and you're trying to capture like legit real life stuff and evaluate based off that, but that I mean that's the only way you're really going to get real life information.
Yeah, no, like I said, I love it. I love that
It'd be
idea.
neat. I'd like to try it sometime.
I think so. Whoever's listening, they might go with that and try it. But I think that, yeah, I mean, because like I said, man, you don't know how many people, some good dudes I know that got passed up the first time, and nerves, it's a crazy thing what nerves do. Because like you'll be like, I know this skill, but because you had somebody like I remember I took an assessment for driver one point. And one of the assessors like literally walked up to the pump panel as I'm next to it, and they looked at the number, and then I was just like, "Do you really need to do that right over my shoulder?" But it's just one of those things. It's just yeah, okay. As far as the physical fitness aspect of the job, especially with your department and how they have to operate, and it's no fault of your own. It's just the way it has to be. Firefighters will do what they have to do. How important do you think physical fitness plays a role?
I think it's hugely important and it has been to me for a long time. And, I'm not gonna judge anybody for their lifestyle choices or whatever. I think my personal opinion is I have a duty both even now in a staff position. Like I have a duty to myself and the people around me to keep in shape. I don't ever want to be anybody else's problem, right? I want to be the solution. And so, or at least a potential solution, certainly not adding to the issues. So that's kind of my personal philosophy, and there's a fair few of us that have that, and there's some that don't. And that's but I've seen a lot of people put in a lot of hard work and think to myself like you're making this harder on yourself.
Right.
But no, I would love to see. We have, we push for it in our department as best we can. But ultimately, that's just one of those things that has got to be a personal decision.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm with you. I mean, I know it's a subject some people want to tread lightly on, but like, I never can understand the concept of an individual doing what we do in all aspects of weather, hot, cold, rainy, humid, depending on your location, the amount of equipment. Because it's funny too, because the other day I was thinking to myself, I have a friend that graciously gave me an old Scott pack that I use for my workouts.
Oh,
And
nice.
then I did the same workout when I got to work, and we have the new 5500s. And it's amazing how back in the day to 2024, you would think equipment is getting lighter, but it's getting heavier. And as I was doing my exercise, I'm like, this is a brand new air pack and it's heavy. Like I can feel it. And it's one of those things where I don't know if it's weather because the person is just living in their world, the complacency of this cannot happen in my any town USA. We don't have these issues, but like this, what we do is physically demanding. And I just can't see how people, and maybe they're just oblivious to it, or maybe some know but just don't care, or they need help. And I get it. Like there's definitely things out there you could do. There's people you can talk to and reach out to that can help you. But whenever you have an individual that just they don't care about it, it's like you're making yourself a liability for not only yourself, the department, but then on the flip side, you're putting your family in jeopardy. Because if you don't come home because of a heart attack, it's like then what were you doing this for?
And I think maybe some of it, because I've been, I've been in this mindset before too, where it's some people show up to work not really expecting to work, like you're
Right.
surprised
Yes.
when you're on a fire.
Yes.
And so I think that plays into it too, we're as a species, we're kind of wired to seek comfort, and you got to train yourself to like to be uncomfortable, and to you got to find, wire up some new reward centers to where you get the same emotional and psychological responses from, lifting heavy kettlebells that you would have putting your feet up in a recliner and snacking on some pizza, right? So it's a process, and again, that's why I go back to, and I don't say it's a pawn off responsibility. I think every department, every leader has a responsibility to their people to encourage the most healthy behavior as possible, but ultimately it's got to be that individual kind of waking up one day and be like, dude, I don't want to do this anymore. Like, I got to change something. And that's where we swoop in and we say, well, we're here to help. Let's go.
Definitely, definitely. Okay. When to say when to recruit an individual that's not cutting it, and this is definitely in your realm. Like, so if I am a candidate for Rural Metro, and I have deficiencies, and you have taken the time to go, hey, like we're gonna work on this, but at the end of the day, the person's just not getting it. And I know no chief wants to have to like let somebody go or just tell them like, hey, I'm sorry. But in this field, sometimes you just gotta say, I'm sorry. So
Yeah,
what's your take on that?
I think like anything, it's probably going to depend to some degree on the individual you're dealing with. When I went through my recruit academy, I was like, I didn't play a lot of sports growing up. I was kind of the lazy gamer kid. And I mean, my recruit academy was the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life, like by far. And if it hadn't been for people that were there to encourage and support and take a little bit of extra time with me, then I wouldn't be where I am now. Like, no chance, right? So I think you can't write anybody off too quickly. Personal relationships as much as possible, figure out where they're coming from, kind of what their motivation was in starting this, how dedicated are they really to succeeding? You fight an uphill battle. At some point, if it truly feels like they're posing a more of a danger to themselves and others than anything, then yeah, I think you gotta snip that one off before it gets worse. But for me personally, I want to be able to go to bed knowing that I tried everything I could to get this individual on a better path or help them make a better decision before I stepped in and took matters in my own hands, right?
Right. And one of the things I love that you said was like, have patience. Not everybody gets it like me. I'm a visual person. If you have to explain something with me with words, depending on what it is, I might get it. And then most of the time I'm gonna go, okay, I'm a visual person. Like I need you to show me. Like, whenever my department, when we went to Minuteman, my first notion is, why are we reinventing the wheel? Like I just got used to what we have and now we're doing something else. So I literally took pictures of how it's loaded and I have to take a picture and then I study the picture and I'm like, okay. And then I actually have notes in my phone on the iPhone of, all right, this is how you pack it first. All right, an ear here, even fold, whatever. Like that's how I have to learn. So I totally understand your concept and I hope other, especially if you're in a training division setting, like everybody learns differently. You got to take your time. Not everybody can get it the first time, but more importantly, like there are a lot of individuals that are visual. They need to see it. They got to put their hands on it in order for them to get it. And we just need to have that patience.
You got to understand that everybody learns differently and everybody needs different amount of sets and reps before something becomes, really ingrained and they're going to be kind of on their own path and their own journey. And, hopefully through patience and relationships and trying some different manners, you find something that speaks to each person and kind of brings them together. But yeah, every now and then you got somebody that's not quite going to cut it. And I think to those people too, it's, generally some good, deep questions is, why are you really here? What are you really hoping to get out of this? Are you really sure this is for you? I mean, that sort of stuff can kind of help make the decision for you too. Or they'll dig a little bit deeper, right? So.
Absolutely. Okay. Awesome. I always like to ask this last question, and I always like to emphasize it because if firemen are the greatest people on earth, but then they could be your own worst enemy. But to me, everybody has aspirations and goals. I mean, I would hope so. Especially I mean, in life in general, but I always like to ask, where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it up? Like, you never thought when coming into this game you would be a division chief of training, but are you going to stop yourself there, or do you see yourself going higher?
I don't know. And this is if any of my guys listen to this, they've heard me say this before. Like my only goal, twofold, I've said it a couple times, like I want to be wherever I can to do the most good for the most people. And maybe that means spending the rest of my career as a division chief, the training. I'm totally cool with that. Maybe I'm deputy, maybe I'm the fire chief. Hopefully not, but we'll see. I don't really care. As long as I feel like I'm relevant, that I'm providing quality leadership and good decision making for my fire department, and that I am making things better for them than they would be otherwise. Beyond that, my as far as like what drives me, my education and my training and stuff like that, I don't want to hit any closed doors. So if I retire as the division chief, I want that to be because I chose not to go any further. Or somebody that really was legitimately better than me got selected for whatever position. Not because I hit that point and I was lacking a piece of paper or something along those lines and now that door's closed off to me, right? So I want to do the most good for the most people and I don't want to hit any closed doors. And if I can spend, the rest of my career doing that, then I'm a happy camper.
Okay, love your answer. I have no there's no rebuttal on that. That it's a personal question I like to ask, and I love when and most of the time everybody gives a genuine response. It's crazy that if an individual has aspirations to be fire chief, other firemen here, like you would be terrible. Like, oh my God, like why would you want to do that? But everyone, like I said, hopefully has goals and aspirations. But there is one more thing I want to ask you before I leave, because if I don't, my training chief's going to be like, what the hell, Danny? So you're a training chief. When it comes to an individual that wants to go to outside training, does your department offer, and only answer if you can, does your department offer like, all right, I want to go to FTTN, chief. All right, cool. We will pay for your way, pay for your meals, and give you the time off. Or is there a give and take? Whereas if you go, okay, you want to go, I need you to use your time, but we will pay for everything. Like, how do you guys work that?
So we budget, I budget in X amount of like conference attendances for every year, X amount of NFA, which obviously with NFA there's not a huge cost, but as much as I can think of, and like we I did this 2 months ago, last month, a couple months ago. So as much as I can think of for next year, I try to budget that in. So like we can send four people to FDIC full ride, right? Or we can send whatever the case may be. Beyond that, we have a budget, a training budget, like discretionary budget. So if I can't afford to 100% pay somebody's way to go somewhere, we'll work something out with them where it's like, yeah, we'll cover the class, but you got to use your vacation time instead of training time. Or, hey, this class is, you know, super cheap, so it's not in the budget, but we can cover the whole thing. So it's some of it's case by case. Some stuff's baked in to where we're going to do full rides for stuff, and some of it we work with the employee, but with the member. But we're never, I mean, really, like I've only been doing this 11 months. I've not said no to anybody. There's people that we've had to come to, you know, do some compromises, but we've sent people where they want to go because it makes us better.
Absolutely. Okay. I'm glad I asked it. Hopefully he heard that, Chief S.
Yeah.
Hopefully you heard that. The way I look at it too is it's been my experience that we have firefighters who wanna, hey, Chief, I'm gonna go take this class. Okay. And depending on where in the fiscal year it lands, how the budget happens, because things happen. If the overtime budget went a little bit over and we don't have money, it's like, hey, I can send you, we can pay, but you're gonna have to use your own time. And then you get those be like, well, why do I have to use my own time when such and such was able to go? Like, I understand the case by case basis, and I always like to ask a training chief this, but I also feel like, and for those listening, if you really want to better yourself, sometimes using your own time shows the word initiative comes to mind. But like for me, I usually pay for my conferences. And then all I ask my chief is, I just want the time. And he'll be like, you don't want us, but like we can pay for your class. And I'm like, I don't want you to pay for it. I'm paying for it. I just want the time. But like, and what pretty much what I'm getting at is sometimes there are things you are going to have to do to show the organization or your training chief, like, hey, I legitimately want to make myself better. Don't worry about it. But if, and you know, and I hate whenever they get mad or they harper over, well, yeah, they said that they're not paying, so I'm not going. Like, so I'm not doing that. Like, sometimes you gotta invest in yourself to get the dividend back.
Yeah, totally. And you know, fortunately, my experience, again, super limited so far, has been the people that are interested in going to these classes and going to the conferences and stuff, they're not the people that are going to be completely offended and shut down if we ask them to pay for part of it. So it's not been an issue. And like I said, we find creative ways to do things. We have a tuition reimbursement program that is technically a separate budget, so they can do tuition reimbursement to get some of the conference stuff or class coverage is paid. So there's creative ways to work around it. But now if somebody's going to take the time, really even the guys that just take the time to find a class they want to go to and submit the form and like ask, like that's huge. That's a lot of initiative in and of itself. So yeah, we want to work with them, make sure they can go where they want to go.
Absolutely. Awesome. Love it. Love it. Chief, I really want to say thanks for coming on. Thank you for even answering my phone call. Cause you
Oh
know,
yeah, for sure.
people will be like, I don't really know a 704 number. So, but, you had graciously accepted my, invitation and, no, this has been a great discussion. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate, I hope I don't mess his name up. Kevin, is it Kate or Cotty?
Kate.
All right, Kevin Kate. Hey, sorry, Kevin, but I'll say it again. Kevin Kate, I appreciate you, pal. You sent me the information. You made this happen. Chief, you accepted the invitation. So I just want to say, seriously, thank you for doing this.
Yeah, man, for sure. It's been a lot of fun. Let me know if you want to do it again.
Oh, definitely. I'll take you up on that for sure. All right, Chief, you have a good day.
Thanks, you too.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.